Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Good afternoon and happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. I am also a romantic, a believer in love, a supporter of marriage. There's a lot of things that could be on that list. Anything you'd add?
No, I mean, of course, we all have a myriad of things that could describe us that would take longer than the little card that I have to read every week.
So I wonder, though, how many people, when they have their, you know, bio, whatever that is, their life resume, would put in their lover, right? Or advocate for love.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something that we are told to put on our resume, it's something we're proud of, you know, married for 35 years. Like we'll say worked for 35 years or have collected stamps for 35 years, but we don't necessarily come out and say married for 35 years as part like a badge of honor.
Yep.
Would you feel that that's something worth denoting in your resume?
It's worth it, but like you, I would say it's not probably something commonly done. I would say that I would be was happily married for 16 years, but I think I would just leave it at that and let people assume that it's a happy that it's a loving relationship.
And so with Valentine's Day coming up, of course that's the theme today, not of course, because how would you think that it was? But we're doing Valentine's Day themes this week. One, because next week I have a guest coming in that should be very interesting. And two, because I wanted to give everyone out there enough time to get their Valentine's Day plans together. Because if you don't plan ahead, you end up, you know, running to CVS for the leftover card that says, you know, Feliz Navidad.
And the Russell Stover chocolates.
Exactly. The one with the thumbprint in it because someone opened it and started it in the store. So it's one of those things that's worth spending some time thinking about. And I like to do the show. And it's funny because I was thinking about, you know, do we do a Valentine's Day show again? You know, we tend to do one every year. And, you know, are we ever going to convince those people that are Valentine's Day haters to love Valentine's Day? A couple of things happened that kind of drew me back to the importance of talking about love and talking about our relationships and talking about the importance of honoring those relationships on days like Valentine's Day or taking that day out because love is one of our primary functions as human beings. It's a biological part of our brain. And our social norms, the way things have evolved in our modern era, have removed love or kind of tried to squash that biological drive for love down out of the way to make more room for other things like career, video gaming, bungee jumping, other thrill sports. So do you Valentine's Day?
Sure.
Okay.
I try to make it special. I mean, some years more successfully than others, but I try not to rush to the CVS on February 13th, but it's happened.
Well, and I don't want to wreck your surprise because I know your lovely bride listens, but you got something special? Not going to let it go? Not yet. Okay. Well, you better get the reservation. So you go out to dinner person or do you make something?
No, I usually make something, a card and perhaps flowers, that kind of thing. Pretty traditional.
And so, aside from Valentine's Day, how is it that you express love in your life on a regular basis? Tough one, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm usually good to my wife, you know. I try to always be kind and kiss her good morning and kiss her good night and that kind of thing. But no sort of overtly outward appearances like that.
Right, you're a little contained with your emotions.
Yes.
There was a great quote that they'd interviewed a man, someone of very contained emotions, and he and his wife had come in for counseling, and she said, "He doesn't tell me that he loves me. He hasn't said, 'I love you,' in the last month." And he looked at her, you know, with a very serious face and said, I told you last month, and nothing's changed since then." And so how we communicate love to each other, how we let the other person know that we love them and how they accept or feel love is really integral in the success of a lot of marriages. So today we're going to explore the vast landscape of love and biology and relationships and Valentine's Day. And I look forward to hearing from you on those topics, because I know we all have a varied interests and experiences when it comes to love. So hopefully something will spark your interest, and you'll give us a call at 805-781-3875. I am Elizabeth Barrett, and there's a lot of ways to be part of the conversation. Our Facebook page is a good way to keep up with the topics every week. Our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can check out previous shows by visiting the kcbx.org website. Under the News and Talk tab, we're right at the top there, and all of our shows are loaded up, thanks to Ashlyn, our producer. And you can also podcast the show through iTunes. If you just go into your iTunes account and look through the podcast for The Reluctant Therapist, you hit subscribe and you'll get all of the shows, and you can listen to them at your convenience on your devices. So love having you be a part of it. And also, I know that it can be anxiety provoking to call in and go on the air. I get nervous every week coming in and being on the air. So I imagine calling in can cause us some stress. And so if you just want to ask your question or comment and leave it with Jordan, she's always happy to pass it along to me. So you can get your voice heard in a multitude of ways. And I hope you will. So Here's some of the things that kind of stimulated this conversation this week. One, I'm always thinking about love, and my husband will attest to the fact that it's one of the primary things in my life is maintaining and sustaining my relationships, not just with my husband, which is my primary relationship that I feel committed to maintaining and sustaining, but also with my children and with my family and with my friends. I really put that part of my life in the number one position, above all else. And I understand that I've been very privileged to have the ability to make the time to make my relationships the number one priority in my life, to kind of be the keeper of love or sharing of love or maintaining relationships in our family as a priority. And I think that it's sad that it takes having the opportunity or the time or the privilege to be able to put your relationships first. Because for many, many people, the amount of time it takes to keep a roof over our heads or put food on the table or to keep up with the demands of our work lives, and let alone keeping in shape and taking care of our own mental health and well-being, that where we place maintaining our love relationships drops further and further because of those modern day demands. And it's also interesting, just as a side note, that when we think about the modern conveniences and how, you know, since the 50s in the modern era where all of these appliances were created to free up time in our lives for other things, that we haven't put more time into our relationships or being together or creating memories, those things that sustain our mental health and well-being, but we've actually put more time into other devices or other technologies, right? Getting lost binge-watching television shows or texting or feeling bad about ourselves because we're looking at social media all day long. It's like for all of the freedom that these modern conveniences have given us, we do not put that time into laying under the stars with a loved one or having a conversation with our children without our devices sitting in between us. You know, and so it's something to consider. If you're struggling in the love relationship field, in your intimate relationships, you might want to make a clock of your day and look and see where your time is spent. You know, how much time do you really invest in those relationships? Because your intimate relationships can't be initiated and, you know, a marriage happens and then you put it aside and you focus on the other responsibilities in your life. It's what happens, but it's not the way strong marriages are sustained. So I think one of the things that's most challenging for modern day romance is that the modern day expectations for work, staying socially connected on social media, keeping up with our health and well-being has pushed the maintenance of our intimate relationships down so low that these relationships struggle. And when we didn't have those diversions, the extent of those diversions, it was easier to maintain those intimate relationships. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, we were much more agrarian as humans. We sustained intimate relationships, not just creating children and being in love romantically, but these relationships also were important to our economic health and vitality, that families, husband and wives, worked farms together. They worked hand in hand raising the children. It was much more egalitarian the way that relationships worked. So we've gone through kind of this evolution of marriages and intimate relationships that, you know, swept through this very male-dominated, women as subordinate spouses for a period of 50 years or so, if not longer. And then, of course, with the feminist movement, we saw this high spike and rise in divorces as people, women especially, wanted more autonomy, wanted more equality, wanted to have an equal say in the relationship. And so the fallout from that spike in divorces in the 70s has kind of put us in this quagmire here in 2016, where you have a generational break between grandparents and grandchildren, or great-grandparents and great-grandchildren, where the very traditional marriages that have been around for 60, 70 years, and they still feel connected and romantically in love and invested in each other, they look at this younger generation and say, you know, why do you hop around from relationship to relationship? Why don't you settle down? You know, they don't understand that lack of commitment. But then between the great-grandparents and the great-grandchildren are the two generations that went through the spike in divorce and the fallout of the next generation avoiding marriage or having another high rate of divorce. And so you see a lot of anxiety about marriage in the last two or three generations, and not really sure how this is supposed to work, because they don't really want to have the traditional marriages of their great-grandparents, where the, you know, man's in charge and the wife follows the rules. But they don't necessarily want to just cohabitate and be roommates with each other or hop from relationship to relationship. And they definitely don't want to go through divorce, having watched their parents' generation or their grandparents' generation have the highest rate of divorce in our cultural history. And so they're stuck kind of wondering, how does this work for us? So that's the first piece of it. The other part was a phone call I had a couple weeks ago. So I'm driving up, you know, I have my granddaughter up in Pacifica, and I woke up a couple Friday mornings ago. And it's an interesting thing, because we're talking about love and how love emerges inside of us. And, you know, when the baby was born, it was very exciting to be there for her birth and to watch my daughter, you know, bring life into the world. It was wonderful and magic. But, you know, that overcome feeling with love of another human being wasn't there initially. It's just like, oh, I want to take care of this little baby, but not enwashed with it. Well, so 2 months into it, or 2.5 months into it, I woke up a couple weeks on a Friday morning, and I turned to my husband. I said, I got to drive up and see the baby. I just need to smell her and see her little face. So I drive up to the Bay Area, and on my way there, I'm just loving life and loving my family. And I get a phone call, and it's my younger daughter in tears, just hysterical crying, because her boyfriend of a year had broken up with her, and she was just demolished. And so my heart now is breaking for her, and also feeling great love for my grandchild, and that mixed emotions of, oh, I hate that my child's heart is broken and that she has to go through this. But of course, would we give up that year of magical love and, you know, being young and experiencing all the wonders that go with it? And so I'm kind of trying to talk her through, you know, breathing and taking care of herself and letting herself feel the emotions, and, you know, just try not to protect her, but at the same time, you know, wanting to kind of honor that this is a struggle. And so, of course, the news of the breakup goes to the family, and my dad's response is, you know, well, don't let her get too hung up on another guy right away. She shouldn't be focusing all this energy on relationships, because she's in college and she needs to, you know, focus on that. And she shouldn't be getting, you know, so attached to all these guys. Now, of course, there's part of my dad that hates the idea that her heart was broken, so he just doesn't want her to go through that again. But there's another part that's also that social message that's being sent to this generation and the generation above them, that, you know, stop paying attention to what your biology is saying about falling in love, and pay more attention to your personal accomplishments and getting that degree and getting a job and establishing yourself. Because the love part, you know, that'll happen anytime. But you really need to focus on the degree. And I listened to my dad, and I can appreciate it. I can appreciate his feelings, but as a therapist, as a psychotherapist, and as someone who, you know, works in the university with this age group young person and reads a lot of research, especially the research of Helen Fisher, whom I really appreciate, there is a great biological push at this age of 18 to 25, starting around 16, actually, 16 to 25, 16 to 30, to find that mate. You know, our biology is pushing us. And they've located, thanks to Helen Fisher's work, parts of the brain that actually drive that desire, that craving for romantic love. And interestingly enough, the drive for romantic love is in the same part of the brain as thirst and hunger. So it's a primary survival mechanism of the brain, romantic love, thirst, and hunger. So we can't live without it. So our biology is pushing us into these relationships, and yet our social norm is saying, no, you need to go another direction. You need to, you know, want your career first and then worry about getting married later. And then the other dilemma is that we're living such a long time. And so it's a challenge to get married at 19, 22, 25, you know, even, and sustain that marriage for the next 60, 70, 80 years. So if we are expecting to push marriage up till 30 and childbearing till later than that, then how do we adapt to the push of the biology to make attachments? So where are you on this topic? You know, what do you think about love? Is it something that's a priority in your life? Is it something that you feel comfortable, confident in? Would you put it on your resume, a successful lover, someone who has had a successful marriage? And where does Valentine's Day play into your year plans? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. And of course, I have tons that I love to say on the topic of love. But I'll follow a little biology first. So Helen Fisher's work, and it's funny because my husband, you know, spent time reading stories of the sea. He's really, you know, loves stories of history, stories of all kinds about the oceans and backpacking, whatever it is, outdoor nature. And then I, of course, am always looking for any of the material I can find that has to do with love and marriages and parenting and, you know, those things in the psychotherapist wheelhouse. And so I've spent a lot of time watching videos and reading books and articles by Helen Fisher, who is actually an anthropologist and not a psychotherapist. So she's done a lot of the brain research and how, you know, love relationships and romantic relationships work. And so she says, you know, there's three parts of the brain that are activated in when it comes to romantic love. Three different parts of our brain are all part of this process of creating these relationships. The first one, as I said, is that survival mechanism of thirst, hunger, and romantic love in part of the brain. And it actually sits right next to the part of the brain that's linked to our sex drive. So that makes sense, you know, that our sex drive inspires us to go out and find romantic love. And then there is the part of the brain that creates that attachment, that long-term attachment for mating, because human beings really are built to be monogamous. We also are adulterous by the numbers, but we are primarily a solo pair. We like to bond in pairs. So those three areas of the brain that work on long-term relationships and help sustain marriages are the lust, attraction, and attachment parts of the brain. And when we try to ignore those, we tend to find ourselves behaving in kind of similar drive and crave behaviors, right? If we ignore our desire for our sex drive or our romantic love drive, it's like trying to ignore being thirsty or hungry, then we try to fill those drives in other ways. So we see higher rates of addictions, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, those other things that drive up our feelings of dopamine and serotonin. We also might, you know, exercise to extremes because our body is craving those chemical releases, those feelings of attachment. And if we ignore them, we tend to find them coming out in other ways. 805-781-3875. Jeremy, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to offer up a counter argument. I think that setting romantic love aside and just calling it love, mm-hmm. I could agree with you. But when you specify it as romantic love, I feel like that discounts the people who are searching, you know, for, say, the love of self and learning to really love one's own self, whether through, you know, a religion or meditation or something like that. And I think that there are probably a lot of monks that would argue we can live without romantic love. And I think also that we seek the love of another to sort of mask our own lack of love of our own self. And I think that's where ego gets involved with love.
I appreciate that. I find it a little bit sad. I mean, I understand, you know, for the religious aspect of searching for love, because if you look at agape love, right, that love of something greater than ourselves, I think that is a more existential, esoteric type of love. But I guess I was looking at more, just because I've been listening to a lot of Helen Fisher's arguments, that there is the biological part of, you know, why the human being is here and what drives us, and that need to be connected to others. And maybe it's not necessarily a romantic love in a marriage or, you know, an intimate love in that way, but that we all seek and desire some sort of human connection with others. And
well, I will say that I am not an enlightened being. so I've had my heart broken and all of that. But I think that if you can love your connection to nature, if you can love being a part of this planet on a broader sense, I think that love can trump ego and can trump your desire to have to be connected to another, because that's what leads to broken hearts. It's not having loved, it's believing that they should love you because you loved them. How dare you not love me anymore? I mean, that's where the broken heart comes in.
Well, that's also the poetic part of the broken heart, though, too, because, you know, if you look at, again, I'm going to go back to the biology, and then I'll try to not just do biology the whole day. But the broken heart actually comes from the chemical response to having love that we felt we had or did have withdrawn from us, and the withdrawal that our body goes through, not having that serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin releases that we were having. But I agree with you, Jeremy. I mean, I believe that this whole sense of awe and love of self and love of the world can be a part of our experience with nature and acceptance and letting ego go. But I guess I'm kind of focused on this other, like the drive for human interaction and how strong that is, and how I don't want to, I'm concerned that our modern day obsession with career and technology has pushed us even further away. You know, it's like, I don't want to push us further away from trying to create successful long-term relationships. And so part of my concern is, if, you know, people say, well, that's okay, I don't need to commit myself to another because my heart could be broken, so I'll just become a monk in essence in some way and find, you know, love of self and commitment to nature. I don't know if that helps our mental health and well-being in the long run.
Well, as I said, I'm not a monk. I'm not enlightened. I'm married, but my goal in my marriage is to love without ego, without the expectation of having to be loved back.
That's a beautiful sentence. You tell me when you get there.
okay. And then, if.
Yeah, if. But I appreciate that, and I mostly appreciate you taking the time to call and share it, because I love to have a little sand in the shoe in the conversation.
Well, I really appreciate you doing what you do, so thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Happy Valentine's Day.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just joining us, this is a show about love and all the aspects of love. And I kind of wanted to focus on the successful part of love today. You know, all those marriages that work, all those relationships that we stay committed to. Because it's interesting, in recent studies that were done, 85% of those who were surveyed, or 81%, said that they would marry their partner again, that they, if they had the opportunity, they would marry their partner again. And of that 81%, 75% said, and I'm still romantically in love with my partner. So that's a very high number of marriages. And the thing that's distressing is that that's not the message we hear in the media. That's not the message that we hear in society, right? Because drama and divorce and disaster and disappointment and heartache, it sells. It sells books, it sells movies, it sells products, it sells antidepressants and anti-anxiety prescriptions. And so we don't talk that much about successful relationships or how wonderful long-term romantic love can be, because it doesn't entice us in any way or drive us, you know, into action. It seems too simple. We always think, well, that's other people or they're lying. But there's enough research out there to support the existence of long-term romantic love to make it worth talking about. And if it means taking a day like Valentine's Day and saying, you know what, I'm going to put my heart on the line for this relationship because at the end of my life, it'll be the thing I'm most proud of, then maybe we need to talk about that. How do we make Valentine's Day special? 805-781-3875 is the number for you to call in and join this conversation. Hi, John. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, well, I was, you know, after 40, 50 years of crippled relationships in an industrial society, and for years I've been looking for who coined the phrase banalization of sex, mm-hmm. and I ran into Rollo May's Love and Will. It was written back when I got out of high school, and kind of connected with it back then, but I ended up living it all before I actually read it all. And the point he was making amongst many was that our love in a society that we're so powerless, where we feel powerless, and develop these schizoid personalities, that our approach to love has forgotten the Eros aspect. The four aspects of love is, you know, sex, Eros, agape, and filial love. Mm-hmm. And we've adopted the sex and forgotten about the creative part, Eros, that is where we develop relationship and the beauty and wonderfulness that can come out of that. And it's just become kind of like the physical, sexual thing. And people come out of it feeling nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's become banal. Banal.
Yes. By me. But have you found, because you said over 40, 50 years, but have you found that love that you seek?
Oh, no, I've tried it all and was raised with, you know, Playboy magazine as a coffee table magazine, and that was a folly. And I went through all kinds of folly relationships going, what is wrong with this? And I searched it out, and I actually found Des Moines Morris and his bonding, zoological approach to human bonding that did a lot for understanding how a relationship develops into a lifelong bond. Mm-hmm. But I'm in a society where there's too many broken people around, and it's really hard to find someone that would understand what's really going on, because they came up in the same way I did, and they're just lost. And I don't have any real high hopes. I got dreams, but I don't have any real high hopes for the potential. Maybe in another country, I don't know.
Well, and I think what you're experiencing, because it sounds like you're of your generation of the high divorce rate, and there was almost like this lost generations of failed marriages and failed relationships. And as you said, you know, we lose our way because the people who come up in the most successful relationships come from families with histories of strong marriages. I mean, that's you know, a psychotherapeutic idea of systems, but it actually pans out to be true that, you know, those who come from families of divorce and failed relationships tend to create generations of failed relationships and divorces. And so the dilemma is, how do we stop that pattern in families, you know, that, because it's hard to have a successful love relationship if you've never seen one done right in your life.
Yeah. And well, the Indians figure it takes 7 years to actually get through a bad situation that's mm-hmm. built into your culture.
Yeah.
Seven generations. Finally get it out of there, you know.
Exactly. And so we're only at, you know, probably four generations from that spike in the divorce rate or that kind of social revolutionary change that we went through. So, you know, are we all then just kind of victims of that seven generational change? Because what we're seeing, which is interesting, is that this younger millennial generation they're creating stronger marriages. Now, less of them are getting married, more of them are cohabitating, but those who are getting married are doing it with an intentionality and a commitment to each other that's very different than their grandparents did. So maybe that generational shift is happening, but that leaves a lot of people in the wake, like you're talking about, who crave that connection but haven't been able to find the partners or make it happen.
I've been saying it for years. There's nothing wrong with the kids. It's the culture, and you know, as people used to try to blame the youth and scapegoat the youth. The millennials, I'm behind them all the way. They're adaptable, and they can see the mistakes, and their cohabitation patterns are just like my own. I whenever I even thought of the term marriage, I actually saw the word divorce growing up, and I never saw a successful marriage in any part of my family. so I wouldn't know. But good luck to them, and I hope that they hang on to their humanity and find something to keep their feelings, you know, actually feel things, not becoming, as quote Rollo May, an affectless society where they feel nothing.
No. John, thank you for bringing that up, because it is. It's a huge concern, and thank you for taking the time to call. Because one of the other things that came up in the research I was doing, and it, you know, again, this stood out for me because it touches into something that I feel very strongly about. But Helen Fisher says, you know, one of the things that is unspoken of is 150 million prescriptions that are written every year for antidepressants. And one of the big side effects of antidepressants is it affects your sex drive. It can often just kill your sex drive, right? Not only is it numbing your feelings or making you kind of emotionless, but it also inhibits your ability to connect with to the hormones needed to feel bonded and connected to others is destroyed by the use of the antidepressants. And I think also the anti-anxiety medications, you know, tend to have a numbing, sedating effect in our inability then to create or release the dopamine, serotonin that we need to be connected. And so Helen Fisher went on to say, you know, I see the use of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications as actually a vaccine for love, because it makes it almost impossible for relationships to thrive when one or both members of the relationship have their natural drives inhibited by these medications. And again, as I always said, it does not mean that these medications can't be helpful and are necessary for a certain segment of our population, but we have to wonder why 150 million prescriptions are being written when the American Psychiatric Association themselves has come out and said that 76% of those on these pills don't really need them. So if we know we have a biological drive towards love and attachment, we feel this desire to open our hearts and be connected to others. And yet we're getting messages from society to put that on hold, that you shouldn't follow your heart, or you shouldn't allow yourself to be open to relationships in case you get your heart broken, in case you're disappointed. And if we have so many people taking mood-altering prescription medications, let alone all of the non-prescription mood-altering substances people are ingesting, then it makes it even more challenging for relationships to be successful. Because I don't know any marriages that can be successful if one partner is struggling with addiction, whether it's to porn, whether it's to technology, whether it's to some sort of substances. You know, we talk about the legalization of marijuana and the hope for this in the cases of a lot of medical disorders, but it also can flatten your affect and make it very challenging to have intimate relationships. So where are we on this? Where are you on this? And how is it you feel about love? Because again, I'm not giving up on Valentine's Day. I think we still have a conversation or two to have about Valentine's Day. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're going to come back and talk more about love. But as we go into our little break, I want to send out this little number to my husband in anticipation of Valentine's Day.
You're my blue sky, you're my sunny day. Lord, you know it makes me high when it's time to love my way. Time to love my way.
Elizabeth Barrett, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you're listening to Public Radio KCBX. We're talking about love and Valentine's Day and our human desire for connection and the messages that we've been told and that we're passing down to our children to not put so much energy into our relationships, because if your heart is broken, it's awful. And I'll admit, you know, there is a withdrawal that happens when relationships end. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, it's been so hard watching my little Kelly go through, you know, her heartache. But the growth that happens when we survive the heartache of lost love, the things we learn about ourselves, the things we learn about how to maintain relationships or what it takes, you know, the good communication skills, the problem solving skills, the ability to give grace to another person, those are all important things that we learn in these kind of dating experiences while we're young. But I understand the fear of investing ourselves in a relationship so fully, opening our heart, because we do create a chemical attraction. You know, when we touch someone else, when we kiss someone else, we have an orgasm with someone else, you know, when we are intimate with someone else, our body releases chemicals, hormones, dopamine, serotonin, vasopressin, and oxytocin through orgasm. These things attach us to another. And so when a relationship ends and we stop having that physical contact, our body does physically withdraw, goes through withdrawals, the shakes, sweaty armpits, racing heart, just as if we were coming off of cocaine use or heroin addiction. I think Stanton Peale said of the seven most difficult substances to withdraw from, love is number one, followed by fat addictions, addictions to drugs. I mean, it's incredible the physical connection our body has to another human and how difficult it is to come off that. So if you're going through a breakup, just a little side advice, what you can do to help your body work through the withdrawal of that loss of the relationship is exercise more to expel those hormones that are running through your body. Get massages, because that touch helps to invigorate your dopamine production so that you feel better and more joyous. Eat chocolate, eat strawberries, because they contain the same chemicals as some of the hormones that we release when we're in love. Sleep a little bit more, cry a lot, it releases the toxins. And also trust that you will live through this, that we can get through the other side of heartache, and that that bonding experience of sharing your life with another person ultimately, you know, is a greater benefit to us than the pain of going through the loss of breakups. But the tricky thing is, how do we maintain those relationships, right? What does it take to have a successful, thriving marriage? What does it take to be someone who 60 years into marriage says, I would remarry this person I spent my life with? Remember what I said, 81% of those people have said, I'd remarry my partner. So let's talk about that. What are those relationships doing that we're not doing? And how can we follow that model? 805-781-3875. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, I have a quick statement about reference. You were commenting on antidepressant drugs as to inhibiting sexual and love.
Yes.
I feel is totally incorrect.
Okay.
Because I don't experience what you're saying, and I'm on Lexapro. And I've never, ever experienced not loving my wife or not being unable to have sex. So a blanket statement like that is incorrect. Well, I experienced this for myself, and I just think you need to do a little bit more research on making a blanket statement like that, that people on drugs can't be in love or can't have sex.
Well, what I said, Bruce, I didn't say blanket across the board. I said that we need to pay attention to the amount of people that we're putting on these medications, because couldn't be happier that this is an effective medication and course for you, because that's what we want as clinicians, is to help our clients and to find, you know, comfort and mental health. But statistically, and it's the American Psychiatric Association themselves said that up to 76% of the people on these meds shouldn't be on them and are having negative reactions. So I'm happy you're having the positive impact, and I did not negate that that's an important piece for a lot of people's mental health, but I do think it is important to share that information. That's not just my blanket statement. It's from the American Psychiatric Association.
Well, sometimes they're not correct either.
That's true. Well, all I can hope is that you continue having great mental health and that it continues working for you, because ultimately being able to love and appreciate your marriage is the most important thing.
I think first it comes down to attitude. And if you love yourself, you won't have a problem loving anyone else. And I just don't think a drug will stop that. I think it's an attitude that a person has about themselves. And a lot of these people don't love themselves. Therefore, they can't love anyone. I don't care what kind of drug, or if they're not on the drug, that's the biggest problem in our society right now. Hmm. They do not love themselves. Without that, there is no love.
Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate your perspective, and I do agree, you know, and it's come up a couple of times, say that the importance of the love of self. And I love that as a goal, because we should all love ourselves and accept ourselves. The tricky piece with that, I mean, it's interesting, you know, Jordan, today we've had all guys calling in so far and not any women. And I'm surprised, because we as women are supposed to be the emotion workers of the relationships. But I love that all these men are calling. But the thing that's a challenge in society, because, you know, Bruce mentioned that the problem with society is that we don't love ourselves, and that we're, you know, not, our attitudes are incorrect. But if you look at the media and you look at what young women or even older women and men are subjected to, there are a lot of messages about all the ways that we shouldn't love ourselves, right? That we're not pretty enough, tall enough, strong enough, sexy enough. That when you are subjected to 3,000 media messages a day, trying to sell you products and reminding you that you're not worthy of love, it's really challenging to have full love for yourself. So I do think that that is a huge dilemma in our culture. But I think one of the great drivers of changing that message comes from the messages that parents give to their children, and not just say to your children, you're phenomenal and you're worthy of love, because that really doesn't take children very far. The most effective way you can teach loving of self to children is to model a loving marriage and a loving relationship, and to treat yourself well so your children see that, because it's modeling which is the strongest way that we pass down cultural messages. You know, that again, as human beings, we pass on traits to our children through nature and nurture. And so we have to work on the nurture piece in order to try to build more stable and strong relationships. 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Valentine's Day. And no one's talked about what they're going to do or what the big plan is. Or maybe everyone's scrambling, hasn't thought about it yet. But do you believe there is an importance in honoring a day where we acknowledge the strength of our relationships, that we take the time out away from our busy lives and say, hey, at the end of my life, this relationship, these people that I love and care for are going to be really the things that mattered most. And I guarantee you that for 90% of you, you're going to get to the end of your life and you're going to look back at those relationships, and they will be the thing that was most important. And so I worry that the message we're sending our young people, my college students, is that their focus should be solely on themselves and their career and how they're going to make a living, because when are they going to learn about caring for others, about being in a relationship, about the sacrifice and the compromise that comes from caring for another person? 805-781-3875. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. What's on your mind? Hi there.
I really think I need to just put this contact in my my phone, because I end up calling in every other day. I wanted to call in as a millennial, as a hopeless romantic, as a married man and father. Just I guess some of my ideas and my experiences. You had tapped into some interesting stuff as far as generations and how that motivates each generation, and, you know, hopefully that we're progressing with each one. And, you know, just from my experience, and I mean, whatever you can, you know, add to this, fantastic. But just from what I've seen, my grandpa from my dad was a total scallywag. The guy was, you know, he grew up in El Salvador. So, I mean, there was a very different idea of marriage there. My father, an immigrant, came, married my wife, or my wife.
Hopefully, well, your mom.
Married my mom, and they had, and they're in their 60s now, have such a strong view of marriage. It's less of a hopeless romantic, but more of a we made a commitment marriage, which is interesting. And so for me, to kind of see that, as, you know, growing up, as a view of what marriage, you know, could look like. For me, I think one big thing is, you know, how can I, as a millennial, how can I, as the next generation, even improve that? And I think one thing a lot of millennials are seeing is, you know, maybe dissatisfaction with a generation that was divorced. Mm-hmm. I know for me, in Valentine's Day, it's huge. I mean, not that I try and designate one day to loving my wife, but, you know, it's I think it's absolutely imperative that that we can do everything we can to be loving each other and to put each other first. Because I think, you know, the next step for my generation, and, you know, as we just mentioned, to show my daughter, you know, what love is like and what marriage is like and a loving marriage is to constantly be surprising my wife and for her to, you know, never get bored or never, never cease to be surprised by the way that I love her. And it's a treat to do that. And it's such a, such a blessing that I get to do that. And I can't really say on air what I'm going to do because she might be listening, but I just wanted to, you know, maybe throw that out. Just kind of within three generations of my family, you know, I think if there is a strong willingness to stick together, that, you know, that really, I mean, it just escalates. It escalates to the point where now, you know, not only is our goal sticking together for the rest of our life, but to very creatively love each other often.
Well, Tom, so here's a couple things that I'm going to throw out there because you have seen for yourself the changes over the generation. Here's some things about your millennials that is interesting. When you look at your marriages today, they're much more egalitarian. You're marrying for love more than any primary reason, not just because we want to stick it out together. Also because economically, you don't need to marry. Women don't need to be married to be successful. So you have high expectations. Your generation talks about wanting to marry someone that you trust and can confide in, someone that makes you laugh, someone that will make enough time for you. And when we look at the amount of time that successful marriages or relationships put into it, it's 20 hours a week. 20 hours a week that people are spending together doing, you know, important things like going for hikes or talking or, you know, sharing new experiences or taking up hobbies. Not just sitting next to each other binge watching TV shows, but actually, you know, building activities and commonalities and then being physically attracted to each other. Like those reasons for marrying are a great foundation for long-term success. But the one thing that I want to add, though, Tom, is that it's more than just saying we're going to stay together for life. The other piece that the older generation has that your generation doesn't quite get yet is that you have to look at marriage from the end point and not where you are, right? You have to look at marriage as how it will be over the long run and not look at it from day to day. Do I love you today? Do I hate you today? Which is what the younger generations tend to do, look at the moment to moment, how they're feeling and make decisions based on the moment to moment. And the older generations had a bigger picture scope. And that's what's going to really be necessary for a lot of these younger marriages to succeed. You with me?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks for taking the time to call in. I'm glad I'm on your speed dial.
Definitely.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Hi, Gina. You're on the air. What's on your mind? Gina, are you still there? Oh, maybe Gina will give us a call back. How about Jackie? You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was calling because my husband and I have a new baby, and we're having so much fun being parents to the new baby, but with Valentine's Day coming up, it's made me take a few seconds to kind of think about the fact that we're having a great time and everything's going well, but neither of us are prioritizing our marriage. We're really just excited about the baby. So before things kind of get out of control and, you know, too far down the road with the baby focus, I want to know if there's any tips or thoughts of how we can proactively kind of maintain and make the marriage special while we still love and cherish the moments with our newborn.
I thank you so much for calling in with that question because...
And I can take it off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling in. So,
thanks.
Jackie, here's what you can do. Marriage is... I use this example of a plant. If you look at your marriage as a plant and you have to care for that plant, tend the plant, water it, nurture it, give it sunlight, your marriage requires the same things. And so as much as the new baby is a wonderful part of your life and it's overwhelming and it takes, you know, us to whole different directions of love we never imagined, it's easy to stop paying attention to the plant of our marriage when we're focused on the child. But I'm glad you're already noticing, huh, we don't want to forget who we are as a couple because that's what brought us together to be in this relationship to begin with. So some of the things that are really important to do is to kind of set aside, you know, and it doesn't have to be long periods of time. It's really the little things in marriage that kind of keep us connected. A sticky note on the bathroom mirror saying, I love you, can't wait to see you tonight. Or, you know, putting the baby down and instead of just collapsing on the couch and staring, you know, at the TV, you know, just collapsing together and just looking each other in the eyes. You don't even have to, even if you're too tired for sex at this point or it's not working, you know, you're not ready for that yet, still spend the time just closely holding each other, holding hands, going for a walk. I mean, it's those little things that nurture and tend the relationship until you have the time to really build, you know, greater memories or go out on dates or take weekends together. Because when the new baby is around, you know, it's very difficult to think that you're going to go on, you know, extravagant date nights. But don't lose sight of the little tiny things, the little reminders of love. Because every time you squeeze your husband or wife's hand, every time you kiss them, every time you hold them, every time you bring them a flower from the garden or, you know, say, I noticed how hard, you know, I appreciate you getting up and going to work and supporting our family. Whatever those things you do, those little gifts of love release the same dopamine and serotonin in our bodies that keep us bonded and connected to each other. So it doesn't have to be grand gestures, the little tiniest things to give us what we call the fix, right? You want to get a fix to keep that love hormone racing through you. So those are little things to help you get through this time. But also, as I said before, to always keep your eye on the big picture. You know, the two of you are in this project together of raising this child, and to keep your marriage primary and the raising of the child as part of the marriage, and to work together to create goals for where you'd like your child to go or what experiences you'd like to have with your child or where you would like to see your marriage in 18 years when your child leaves home. If you keep looking at the big picture and make plans together, it'll really help hold the marriage together throughout that time. So thank you for taking the time to call. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. We have time for a couple more calls, 805-781-3875. Gina, you're back. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm back.
Hi. So what's
on
your mind?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. First of all, I like what you had just said, and it kind of ties into what my comment was going to be about Valentine's Day. And I don't really feel like that we should just have one day out of the year where we focus on our loved one. I've been, for the past couple of years, very heavily involved in doing a lot of self-work and really working on my relationship as far as those daily little things to reconnect and how important they are each day to make that time, whether it's just for a moment, like you said, just to look in each other's eye or squeeze their hand if we don't feel like, you know, life just is getting away from us. Because otherwise, you know, it just becomes like a Christmas, you know, holiday waiting for a present and then it's all over.
Exactly. And it does slip away from us, right? I mean, that's the thing that people don't understand, because a lot of our attachment to each other is attitude, as Bruce said earlier. We wake up every day and we make a choice in our marriage. You know, a lot of people will say, well, I just fell out of love. You know, we just stopped being in love. It's like, no, you never just fall out of love. You stop connecting, right? You
right.
change the attitude. And so you have to wake up every day. And I have, you know, funny little ritual, but I wake up every day and I look at my wedding ring, and I've done it forever and I don't know why, but I always do. And it kind of is this, oh, I get to be married again today. And there's, you know, other times I'm looking and going, oh, I'm married again today. You know, it comes and goes, but I have to make that choice, my attitude every day, to make that important. Then the other piece is that we have to do the touching, the holding, the kissing, even in the times we may not be feeling it, because that chemical attraction can slip from us. That chemical bonding that we feel for each other can slip.
Yeah, and the whole morning ritual thing is, as well for me, is there's one that I do where I wake up and I just ask, you know, what can I do to be more loving today, and what can I do to give more love today or show up in a different way? Because it doesn't really ultimately matter so much of what I did yesterday for my partner. That's gone.
Right.
What am I going to do today?
And which can be overwhelming for a lot of people. I think especially for men. It's like, didn't I tell you I loved you last year? Or, you know, didn't I bring candy last Valentine's Day? I think a lot for the more masculine thinkers or pragmatic thinkers is like, do I have to do this love thing every day? And yeah, you do. You do because you get up and go to work every day. And that's kind of been my argument the whole show is if you get up and go to work every day and you're committed to that career, then wouldn't you want to put the equal attention into this relationship that's really sustaining you emotionally and physically? You know,
right. Well, it's the muscle, just exercising that love muscle.
Oh, I love that. we'll leave that in many different ways, Gina. Thanks for taking the time to call. Yeah, we had to exercise our love muscles. I like that, Jordan. We're going to keep it. So just to kind of wrap things up for Valentine's Day, a couple things to bear in mind. One, you can only be successful loving someone if you love them in the way they feel it. And that's very important. So I encourage you to check out Gary Chapman's book, Love Languages, because it's very simple and it talks about those five languages of love that people respond to. You know, some people respond to words of affirmation, some to acts of service, some to receiving little gifts or large gifts. Some feel love when you spend quality time together. Some feel love by physical touch. We all feel love from others in different ways. So in order to successfully love our partners, we have to know their love language and then love them that way. And in the same way, we have to know our love language and let our spouses know what it is. Because it's not fair to say to your spouse, guess how to love me, and then be angry when they don't love you in the way you'd like. You know, I think of the story of clients I had who the husband brought yellow roses every Friday for 10 years until his wife served him with divorce papers. And he was so confused how this happened. And in therapy, she finally said, I hate roses. I like carnations. And every Friday you brought me roses, it just said to me, he doesn't know me. He doesn't love me. And how sad that simple of a change, right? Bringing the right flowers would have changed the course of that relationship. So it isn't enough just to say, hey, I'll bring in flowers and candy and my wife will know I love her or my husband will know. You have to get on the same page, know how to show the love. And the last thing I want you to think about is that when they look at long-term happy relationships, people who say, I would still marry my partner 70 years later, they all have three things in common. They have true empathy for each other. They truly care about and understand the perspective of their partner. They, number two, are able to control their stress and their emotions, right? They work on managing their own stress and managing their own emotions. They don't just release whatever they're feeling on their partner. And number three, they have positive illusions. And this is key. Positive illusions are the ability to overlook the qualities that drive us crazy and only focus on the qualities that we adore. And that attitude is going to drive you for the rest of your life. And finally, turn off all the media. Turn off the social media. Turn off the comparing yourself to others because it's just going to make you feel like you're less than. Just focus on what you have in front of you and focus on the long term. And as always, I appreciate you spending Tuesday afternoon with me. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can podcast our shows at iTunes. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, I appreciate your time and hope you'll join us again next week and supporting Public Radio KCBX.
In the crowd, your love talks to me so loud. Girl, do I do what you do when I do my love to you? When I hear you on the voice turns my ear all the way on. Just the mention of your name seems to drive my head insane. Girl, do I do what you do when I do my love to you, baby? Your
Yes, I got some candy kisses for your lips. Yes, I got some honeysuckle chocolate-dripping kisses full of love for you. Yes, I got some candy kisses for your lips. Yes, I got some honeysuckle chocolate-dripping kisses full of love for you. My life has been waiting for your love. My arms have been waiting for your love to open. My heart has been waiting, my soul anticipating. That will make if to me if I can do all this. Well, just imagine how it's gonna feel when we hug and kiss. Sugar, do I do what you do when I do my love to you? All right. Yes, I got some candy kisses for your lips. Yes, I got some honeysuckle chocolate dipping kisses full of love for you. Yes, I got some candy kisses for your lips. Yes, I got some honeysuckle chocolate dipping kisses full of love for you. My